Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with my fearless producer, Blake. Welcome, Blake.
Thank you.
You were in Disney doing important work, getting prepared for your future career.
Yeah, I got to speak with some cast members there on some ideas for a new project that I'm going to be working on over the year. So,
and this is your big senior project?
Yeah, this is going to be my big senior project. I'm basically making a music video off of one of the fireworks shows.
How exciting for you.
Yeah, it's real exciting. It's also real nerve-wracking because it's Disney, but so high standards.
Wow. It is exciting, but not as exciting as what we're about to do in here.
Yeah, of course.
First up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have Diane Lassick with Listen Up Books. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about Listen Up Books. How are you serving folks?
Listen Up Audiobooks. We started in 2010. The CEO is originally, he built Listen Up in New York City and then moved down here to Atlanta and open studios, and we produce predominantly for the top five publishing houses and Audible, and we have our own publishing arm, and we do museum to audio tours and podcast series, but predominantly we produce audiobooks.
So now, tell us about the trends in the audiobooks. Is that something that's becoming more and more popular?
Absolutely. 34% rise year over year. 2.5 billion over the last 5 years. Ebooks is declining in sales. Audiobooks is the fastest rising area in publishing.
Now, is this something that anybody who publishes a book, is this kind of a must have at this point that you should be seriously considering?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then how does it work with, if you're a published author and you're going through a traditional publishing house, is that something that they include as part of your package when you sign up with them?
Yeah, you can always try to fight for your audio rights to keep them and produce yourself. We also have an independent publishing arm called ListenUpIndie.pub, mm-hmm. where you can go online and fill out a form and we will email you and set up a phone conversation so that we can produce your audiobook. If you're the rights holder.
So now, was that geared towards a lot of these people who self-publish?
Yes, and that's a market that's just exploded because there's so many platforms online that you can do it yourself now.
Mm-hmm.
There's freelance editing, there's Ingram Spark print on demand, so you can do your ebook formatting, print your book and do print on demand and create your own audiobook.
And then you control all the rights because you're doing this yourself?
No. Yeah. The rights holder is always the rights holder. All we do is produce the book for them, and if they want me to distribute worldwide, I distribute in retail and school markets and library markets. And they retain 80% of royalties, and we get 20%.
And then there's a fee, though, also to create the audiobook?
There's a fee to produce it, mm-hmm. but distribution, we don't have any upfront fee to distribute worldwide.
So if they're working with you, that's one of the benefits?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that the distribution, it's variable based on sales. So you win when they win, everybody wins together.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And production-wise, we have very high standards. We have most of our engineers and directors are degreed. They've gone to Full Sail or SCAD or mm-hmm. a university. They're audio engineers. And Atlanta has an amazing talent base for voice talent.
Mm-hmm.
We have incredible actors here. And we have over 200 voice actors in our library of voices.
And that's here in Atlanta, or they can be anywhere?
They can be anywhere, but the majority of them are here. And we actually have quite a few that have their own fan club, you know?
Fan club for voices?
Yeah.
There's fan clubs for voices?
Oh, yeah, because if you fall in love with an audiobook, a narrator, and then you go find all his other books... Or her other
Oh, so
books.
They're choosing books based on the narrator?
A lot of times they are because, you know, if a voice really catches you, you're like, oh, my God, I could listen to that for hours, mm-hmm. you know.
So how do you, like, who picks that?
If a publisher wants us to publish their audiobook, then they'll give us an idea of what they're looking for. And then our casting director will select, you know, five voices that match that. And then the publisher will pick that. If a an author who is the rights holder of their audio, they do that. We do the same thing for them.
And so it's not just their opinion. There's somebody who has knowledge about the industry kind of helping them choose the right voice.
Oh, yeah. We have a casting director that knows. If I say I need someone that's 40 to 50, slight Southern draw, not too intense, then we can find that.
Wow.
Midwest male, 55, you know.
Is this more for nonfiction or fiction, or is it both?
It's both. We do both. Fiction is definitely higher sales in audio, if you were to compare the both. But nonfiction, it would be more like business books or exactly what to say is a good example. That was like a very big bestseller.
And in that case, is the author a lot of times the voice in a nonfiction, or is
nonfiction,
that the same?
Nonfiction, business and self-help, a lot of times it's the author. But mm-hmm. It really depends on what they sound like, you know. You can hope if they're a professional speaker.
Right, then they'll probably be okay.
Right.
Now, when they're doing the audiobook, how does it work, kind of the nuts and bolts of it? Is it something where they're just reading just the book and just word for word, or sometimes do they kind of interject like stories and make it kind of more conversational?
We read straight from a finished manuscript, you know, and the particular narrator has spent time with the book, read it, taken notes, you know, gets a feel for characters, etc. So they know the book.
But it's kind of word for word. They're not taking any liberties.
No.
And that's on purpose.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So as there never is books where they kind of go off script?
No.
That's
straight manuscript.
So that's just the experience of an audiobook is
right.
So if you want something else, then maybe a podcast or something that's
absolutely
more conversational is the appropriate
absolutely
medium for that.
Right.
And then how'd you get into this line of work?
I've been in entertainment from the start. I moved to Atlanta for Turner Broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
Spent 15 years there.
Doing what at Turner?
Building divisions. When he bought MGM, RKM, Warner Brothers, build that. CNN, when it was smaller, and we started syndicating CNN, built some stuff in that area.
And then how did you stumble into the audiobook field?
I was working in more the film industry, and I met Chris actually at a Christmas party for the film industry.
Chris is the founder?
Yeah, Chris Fogg. And he mentioned that he wanted to have his own publishing arm, and I said, I've done that before, so let me have a try. So he did, and we did it.
And then, so you were there at the beginning of this?
The beginning, we built our own library. We have our own, we own rights to about 175 audiobooks now. And so we have our own library. We have our own distribution worldwide. And then in 2015, we built listenupindie.pub for the indie writers out there so they could get their own audiobook.
So then once you did that, did your job change? Or were you now trying to get the word out and recruiting those independent writers, or were they all finding you?
They were finding us online, but also I go into the indie conferences around the United States, and there's lots of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, fiction writers conferences, you know, they're all over.
And how many kind of fiction books are written every year?
I can't give you that, but it's a lot.
Is it like a million?
There are so many books. You have it's when you're entrenched in this, you can't believe how many books every year. So many.
And then are the certain genres more audiobook friendly? Like is romance more popular than
romance,
like science fiction or
romance, erotica, and true crime?
Those are the money
that's
makers.
The human desires. That's the tops.
And so is there if you're just kind of a regular person and you're thinking about writing a fiction book, you should pick one of those three? Too crowded?
You should pick what you like, but in audio, if you're looking at sales numbers, true crime is really big. People love murder, real stories, you know. And then there's also erotica because people can't see what you're doing when you're listening to an audiobook. You know, they can't see the title of the book.
And so then, so when you're doing this kind of work, and so you're ranking, okay, erotica, I got true crime, I have romance. Those are the big three.
Mm-hmm.
And then is it a noticeable dropout for the rest, or does it kind of gradually go down from there?
It gradually goes down. I would love to see literary fiction be number one, but that's not what
humanity's
based on. But there's so much wonderful literary fiction out there. It really is.
So do you consume mostly audiobooks yourself, or are you old school reading with your eyes?
I'm old school, but I rarely even have time for that.
Uh-huh.
I try to get away from screens on the weekend completely, anything.
And now in audiobooks, does the person who likes audiobooks, are they just kind of one at read it? Are they constantly?
Yeah.
Like this is their primary entertainment?
It's taken off because so many people are in traffic. They're multitasking around the house.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a book club and they don't have time to read their books, so they get the audio and listen to the audiobook on the way to work. I mean, audio has just exploded. There are, 630,000 podcasts out there. There's so much audio going now. I mean, we do museum audio. We produce podcast series. We have a new series coming up on Audible that we produced here in Atlanta called mm-hmm. Tribulation, and that debuts in October.
Are those the same genres, like true crime and things like that?
Mystery, true crime kind of thing, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the hot area in podcasts.
So now if somebody was just getting into kind of the true crime genre, is it something that they got to go find a good crime? Like, how do you know what's a good subject matter?
You can go on audible.com and put in true crime bestsellers, and you can see what people are listening.
But the people who are creating the content, are they... Like, are they kind of detectives? Like, how do they know which crime is going to be a good one?
A lot of times, I mean, especially with the top true crime podcasts, these are kids that are, young kids that are finding stories in newspapers and deciding to just go ahead and, do a podcast about it. And some of them are solving the crimes within the podcast,
So then they just pick a top. They go Google whatever, some crime of passion.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the good ones, right?
Yeah.
So they find this and then they just kind of research the newspaper reports.
Right.
And then they start calling up the people.
That's really hot right now.
So that is that
especially
true?
In Georgia, yeah.
So they call up like the people that are involved in the crime.
Yeah, I mean there were two best-selling podcasts in Georgia from kids that were just doing that, finding that out. Yeah.
And then so they're just interviewing the people, talking to them, getting their story. And then they're slowly piecing together maybe, hey, this person might be the one that did it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So there's no way going in you could have anticipated that. Like going in that, hey, audio books that will be solving crimes.
No. No, I mean, I'm always on the lookout for true crime audio books because they're great sellers.
So now do you find the podcaster and then say, hey, you should write a book about this? Like, how does that work? Are you kind of talent scouting podcasters?
No. I mean, we have professional writers that are writing crime, not necessarily just true crime, but crime. And we have one particular series that we sold to Audible, and now we're writing a novel around that series. He's writing a novel around that series, so we'll have the rights to that and do the audio book for that.
So now when there is a crime and that's a public record, is there rights you can get about the story, or you get an individual that was part of that rights? How does that work?
You kind of have to have a piece of work that you've created to copyright it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you have to, like, if I know the victim's father, so I can get that person's perspective and then I can build the content around that story and I can have rights of that. I can get the rights.
But you have to
create the book.
Right.
Now, in terms of the coaching part, is there coaching, or is you're expecting the author to be kind of do the writing part and editing themselves, and then you take the audio when it's ready, and then you do you stay in your kind of lane?
We stay in our lane. We do request professional editing always, because we have narrators that are very busy and they don't have time to edit something. We want a final edited manuscript.
So now say, what's an average length of a book? Like a couple hundred pages, 300 pages?
It could be about 250 pages. So 6.7 hour is an average.
Is that the length of a book is about 6.5 hours, 7 hours?
I mean, give and take.
Right.
Some books are 30 hours. Some books are 2 hours.
30 hours? Mm-hmm. People will listen to a 30-hour book.
Oh, yeah. Especially if they have long trips,
But primarily this is like for commutes. Is that the primary time, or is it like working out at the gym, or
working out, cooking, commuting? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are the three times.
And they're doing this instead of watching TV.
Instead of, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so that way they don't have to pay super attention, but they're following along.
Exactly. And that's what they want, because they have other things that they're doing around the house when they listen to the audiobook.
And then what would you say the percentages from fiction to nonfiction of audiobooks?
I would probably say 80 fiction.
80% fiction. Oh, yeah. So it's that, it's dramatically.
It is dramatic.
And the sales are, 80% of the sales are fiction.
Yeah.
So the people who buy the nonfiction audiobook are the kind of the super fans of that.
Yeah, and a lot of times it's commuters, mail, on a subway, New York, how to sell, how to talk, you know, that kind of stuff.
Now, for you, how can we help you? What is your, like, what do you need more of?
What do we, I need more time.
More time, so we can do that. Blake, get her some more time.
You know. But no, I mean, we're growing. We're slammed always. There's always something going on. So, yeah.
And then so once a person raises their hand and say, hey, I'm ready to do this, let's say, because a lot of our listeners would be probably interested in nonfiction because we're a business.
Right.
So then say a lot of our guests have written books and they don't have an audiobook. And then if we were to send them your way, what would be kind of walk me through what that would be like?
They would go to www.listenupindie, like indie author.
Right.
Listenupindie.pub, like publishing. Listenupindie.pub, fill out a form, and then I get the back end of the form and email them and say, would you like to set up a time to speak about your us producing and distributing your audiobook?
And then say their book is 250 pages. Is that, like, well, what's the cost then to produce the book?
It's determined by word count. So say that's 60,000 words. So 60,000 divided by 9,000 is your per finished hour audiobook. And you take that per finished hour times 350, and that's how much it's going to cost.
And then, so then I agree, we do it, I pay you guys. Mm-hmm. And then, so
you pay half up front and half at the end.
And then, so then that happens, and then now I just hand it to you, and you're, or is that me assuming I'm the narrator? That
it,
price.
It all depends.
Or it's the same price either way.
Excuse me. No. Then we're doing. You're paying for our studio and our post production. You're the narrator. You're not paying for the narrator.
But I'm paying for the studio and post production.
Studio and post production, and then you come into the studio, record, and then we clean it all up, and make an audio book out of it.
And then say I do all that, then that could take. How long? Like a month?
Four weeks.
It takes about a month to go through the whole process.
Right.
How much should I be doing, like, speaking at a time, like, before I lose my energy? Or, like, there's probably best practices, right?
3 hours a day.
3 hours at the most? Mm-hmm. Is that what most people can do?
Yep.
And like a regular person, not a trained narrator?
1 hour of an audiobook is about three in the studio.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In terms of it, they're doing it over and over again?
Right, because you've got a edit our director and an engineer in there, and they're listening to everything going on and making sure it's perfect.
Oh, so they're like kind of as we go, you know what, why don't you do that and kind of punch up this at the beginning.
Exactly.
And then, wow. Mm-hmm. And then for you, what's the most rewarding part?
Getting a bestseller.
How many do you have? What's your personal best bestseller?
My personal best bestseller is a book called Exactly What to Say. And it's by Phil Jones, and it's about how to communicate. It's more of a sales strategy communication book. And we are now producing Exactly What to Say for real estate agents. We are in the midst of that right now.
So now it's a cottage industry.
Yeah, he's a cottage industry.
Is he local here?
No, he's actually, I think he's British, but he lives in New York City. But his books just, there's something about Exactly What to Say that is just unbelievable.
Now, do people with, like, British accent, do they sell more? Like, does British sell more than Australian that sells more than Southern?
Normally, I mean, it's kind of a can't define Midwestern U.S. You know, you can't really define the accent is the best kind of audiobook narration.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say it's certainly not Southern.
It's certainly not
certainly
Southern.
Certainly not Southern, and certainly not, you know, from Boston or New York City. It's kind of that generic Midwestern mm-hmm. Can't Define.
And that's
the most popular.
Now, have you ever done a test where you did one like British and one American voice and then head to head and then the British sells more? Like, is there data for that?
They all audio test a lot of things. Big Audio tests a lot of things. And like I said, it's certainly not going to be the British.
Certainly not.
Yeah, because some people just can't listen to that for 6 hours.
Now, even Harry Potter?
Well, that's a different story. But
you think anybody could have read that?
Well, no, I mean, I think that's a separate thing in itself, but just your average book, it's that Can't Define Midwestern mm-hmm. accent.
And then for true crime, Midwest works really well?
Yeah, depending on me, it could be a Southern Gothic serial family murder thing.
So would Southern be better for that or
oh,
not?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and then, because yeah. it's like kind of part of the mood
exactly,
and the ambiance.
And we've actually had a few bestsellers that were Southern with a Southern narrator.
Do you add special sound effects and things like that?
We can do that.
But not typically?
Probably 95% of audiobooks do not have any special effects.
And it's just their words, just them speaking into a microphone.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. If somebody wanted to learn more, what's the coordinates? What are the best way? Like, do the independent...
If you're an independent author and want to produce your own audiobook, it's www.listenupindie.pub, mm-hmm. P-U-B. And then there's lu.audio, which has all the things.
That's your library?
No, that's listenupaudiobooks.com.
Uh-huh.
That's to buy audiobooks, and some of those are our library. But
the other ones for services?
lu.audio is... museum tours, sound design for films, audio books, everything.
All the
podcasting.
Services.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then you have studios throughout Atlanta that you use?
Yeah, we do. We have 11 studios. We also have Magic Lantern Studios, which is film and video.
And then that you own that or that you partner with them?
Chris Fogg owns that.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hang with us. A couple more guests. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, David Washington with Kiplin Real Estate Consultants. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How's your book coming along?
It's coming along pretty great, as a matter of fact.
So now if you need an audiobook, I got a person for you.
And I definitely would need it.
So tell us about Kiplin. How are you serving folks?
Kiplin Real Estate Consultants and Advisors is a full-service real estate brokerage firm. My expertise has been dealing with, and the simplest way I can say it, is dealing with real estate-related issues. My expertise is in foreclosures, divorce, probate. Believe it or not, the best way I can sum it all up is anything that deals with drama and an address. And there's a lot of that going on right now.
So this true crime, really, that kind of struck
yes.
a nerve there.
Oh, yes.
So now tell us how you got into real estate.
I've been in real estate since 1988. I invested in my very first property, and it's so funny because I started out as a wanting to be a real estate investor from Detroit, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I will.
So you were looking initially just to be an investor.
Well, this is the time where we had the infomercials. So we had the Dave Delgados, the Tom Vools, the Mike and Irene
Miners,
and all those folks. And I was inspired to get into real estate that way. And
So what part? Because it seemed easy. It seemed fun.
No,
you thought you'd make a lot of money.
It seems like you can make a lot of money. I'd already had a little bit of real estate background. I decided to go to real estate school to obtain a real estate license. And unfortunately, in Michigan at the time, specifically Detroit, at the time that I got into to the real estate business, people's homes were depreciating faster than they were paying them off.
Oh, wow.
So even though you had a huge surplus of
he didn't mention that on the infomercial.
Oh, no, they didn't mention that. Nor did they mention that in Michigan, the average average price of a property is about $35,000. So these folks are driving around in Rolls Royces and all these extravagant automobiles, and the average price of a home is $35,000. So how are you able to make $100,000, $200,000 right. on each real estate transaction?
Yeah,
they failed to mention that
well.
That
math isn't adding up.
It did not add up. So what I found myself doing is I would go and approach the homeowner that was facing foreclosure, and I found myself helping them. Most of the Detroiters were somehow or another related to the automobile industry. So when they laid off or they had shift change or when they retooled for the plants or whatever, they laid off in large amounts. And for whatever reason, people were outliving their unemployment and facing foreclosure. So it was a huge surplus of available properties, but they were either upside down or they were negative equity in a property. So I actually learned how to do short sales at that point. And so approaching
and what's a short sale?
A short sale is when you actually owe more on a mortgage than a house is actually than a house can actually be sold for.
So is this now between kind of the bank? So is that the bank's problem or is it still the owner's problem?
It's the homeowner's problem because at the time of closing, you agreed to make these payments and there is no variation as to if the economy goes up or down or whatever the case may be. But when folks are in a position to where they can't make that mortgage payment over a 30-year period of time, you're guaranteed to have a life's issue, a death, a car accident. Something is going to change your whole ability to be able to divorce. That's one of my largest types of clients that I deal with right now that aims towards foreclosure. But at the time you're into this property, 10 years later, 11 years later, something happens, you lose a job, you go through a divorce, you can no longer afford this property. And most people, why wouldn't they just bother to stick a for sale sign in the front yard and sell the property when, you know, they no longer can afford it? Well, if you're upside down on a property, so most folks are just,
there's no incentive because you're going to sell it for, you're going to lose money.
Not only, and there were no incentives at the time. So you had the mortgage companies taking a loss on a property, meaning they can come back after you and sue you for a deficiency judgment. Most folks are just walking away. And I don't know if you ever remember hearing about Devil's Night in Detroit, Michigan. Mm-hmm. Devil's Night is when landlords were upside down in these properties and a lot of homeowners, and they just set fire to them and collect the insurances from them.
They would set fire to the property.
So if you ever Google Devil's Night in Detroit, in Michigan, that's what that was all about, the day before Halloween.
Because it was better for them to not have the building, because then insurance covers, I guess.
Exactly. At least it'll cover the loss and maybe any personal loss that they had, but most likely it just covered the mortgage balances.
So who was lighting on fire? The landlord?
They would pay people to do it. I mean, I can't really get into that. Homeowners.
That sounds like a true crime, right, Diane?
Oh, absolutely.
It sounds like a whole series.
Absolutely.
But so that was really happening, like a epidemic level of happening? Like, so it wasn't just randomly?
So bad to the point that when you get homeowners insurance in Michigan, when you even to this day, when you buy a property, you have to be pulled into an insurance pool. And the basic insurance you would get was called Michigan Basic. And that's the type of insurance because the mortgage companies required you to have homeowners insurance. Mm-hmm. But you would have to be pulled into this big pot. And when Michigan Basic picked your insurance up, it was like the lowest of the lowest type of homeowners insurance you're going to have just to be in compliance with the mortgage company's requirements. Wow.
So then what got you to Atlanta?
Wow. I invested in my first real estate investment from Charles J. Givens.
That's another infomercial,
except I was actually at the airport and I was a part of his workshop. And it had to be over 1,000 people at this hotel. And for whatever reason.
Was that here in town?
No, it was in Detroit, Michigan.
He
was touring around. And they, out of all these folks, they just came over to my table and stuck the mic in my face and said, hey, what are your ambitions? What is it that you want to do in real estate? And I was already involved in the foreclosure side of the business. So by the time I started speaking, they had no idea that I was that engaged.
Right. And you were knowledgeable.
And
you
weren't just like,
this wasn't your first rodeo.
Exactly right. So before you knew it, I had about 20 clients just in getting up and speaking because I was there. You didn't have to buy these folks' course. You could come right locally.
From the horse's mouth, right?
Right from the horse's mouth. So I invested. So what led me here is I came here to visit. And one of my very first celebrity clients, who's now deceased, I won't mention his name, but I found his information in a legal newspaper here in Georgia and found that he was going through a foreclosure situation. And I said, hey, you know, I'm gathering this foreclosure information. And since I was going to Georgia, I brought a couple of investors with me and we picked up our first property and I flipped that property and made $26,000. The investor put in $5,000 and they walked away with $20,000 and I made $26,000. And that was probably the most money I've ever had in my life at 19 years old, coming from Detroit, Michigan.
And then so you, instead of looking at this person as they're in foreclosure, you were able to partner with them to help?
Michigan's foreclosure process and Georgia's foreclosure process is totally different, which is the reason why I love doing what I do. Georgia's foreclosure process means that the foreclosure sales take place the first Tuesday of every month here in whatever county in which the property is located in. And there are 5 counties that surround metropolitan Atlanta. Just last month, there were over 1,000 homeowners that were facing foreclosure.
1,000.
Just in the 5
counties.
And this
is supposed to have like a good economy. And
well, the economy has nothing to do with a death or a car accident or any of that. These are real life issues that foreclosures always will exist, regardless of how great our economy is.
So these are kind of just the bad luck.
I'm not going to say bad luck. I'll say life. I remember the very first time my mother lost our property to foreclosure, I was 16 years old. And she was making her payment on land contract, which in Georgia is called contract for deed. She was making her monthly payment every month. The landlord was not making his payment to the mortgage company. Next thing we know, we get to knock at the door. The marshals are there to evict us.
Even though you were paying and you thought everything was fine.
Exactly right. And that's really what inspired me to get into the business of helping people. Mm-hmm. So let me fast forward. So Georgia's foreclosure process, even though it takes place the first Tuesday of every month, there's no right of redemption, meaning that you actually lose the ownership of your property that day. In Michigan, you have 6 months after the property has been auctioned to live there, what they call rent free. And then you, in order for you to keep that property, you would actually have to pay it off in full, plus all the back payments, penalty, interest, and attorney's fees. In Georgia, the first Tuesday of the month, that is it. That's what we call Foreclosure Tuesday or D-Day.
And then you got to leave.
And you, well, they have to go through the dispossessory process, which is very fast in Georgia as well. You can literally be foreclosed on the first Tuesday of the month and literally set out by the marshals within 30 days thereafter.
Wow.
This is a very, very accelerated process.
And then is that good or bad?
It's bad. it depends on, because just because you're losing your home or you're facing a foreclosure don't mean you're a bad person.
Right.
So let me give you a case in point. I had a client that I knocked on her door, approached her recently. Her mom had just passed. Her mom was 40 years old. This young lady was 20 years old. And she had no job, no, you know, ability to make that monthly payment, but the property was facing foreclosure. Mom died intestate, so, and there was no insurance to cover the balance. So who's really at fault? Life happened. And so my job was to approach this young lady, figure out what can be done to stop the foreclosure. A lot of times people just need an interruption in the foreclosure process just to get a thought on which way do I need to go.
So just kind of pause it for a beat.
Exactly right. I was able to get the foreclosure sale stopped through some creative techniques. And once we got the foreclosure sale stopped, 30 days later, I end up sticking a for sale sign in the front yard because I am a full service real estate broker. The young lady had no options to be able to do anything with the property. We did get her set up with a judge who set the her probate up because there was no rights that she had on the property whatsoever except as an occupant. We did set up the emergency hearing for her to become the administrator. Got the foreclosure sale stopped, got her in control of being able to list that property. I stuck up a sale sign in the front yard. So not only are we looking at a foreclosure, but the property was substantially underwater. So now I'm doing a short sale on the property as well. I ended up getting about 14 offers on the property within the first 6 hours that I had the property listed. And even though we had so many offers, none of which would have covered the entire balance. So I was able to go in, get the foreclosure sale stopped, set her up through the administrator so she has the authority to sign off on the property, put the property on the market, get the short sale initiated with the mortgage company, and they were able to give her a $5,000 relocation incentive just to vacate the property. Mm-hmm. And I sold the property successfully.
So then all the constituents kind of won there.
Exactly right. People can split money. They can't split a property.
Right.
So, yes.
So you got to get it into money.
Exactly right.
And that's what you help people do.
That's exactly right.
And then what about there's something that my dad's old and he gets bombarded with these reverse mortgage stuff.
My God, yeah.
And then they seem a little too good to be true.
Well, they're not. And it just depends on what your circumstances are, what your end game is upon your demise. If you're not planning on transferring the property over to your heirs or splitting the equity in it or whatever, your children have doing well, you don't have any really financial need upon your death, then a reverse mortgage may be a good thing because you no longer have a mortgage payment. Mm-hmm. I was actually able to use a reverse mortgage that had gone through the process of the mother and the father dying. The son lives 75 miles away from Atlanta. He has no desire to be back at the property to do anything with
it. Are you allowed to reverse mortgage a house you don't live in?
No. You must occupy the property as a senior citizen, but both of these people passed.
Right.
So the son didn't want to have anything to do with the property. He was able to enjoy some of that equity when the homeowners pulled that equity out when they got that reverse mortgage. So he's basically saying, David, I just want to sell the property for what's owed on it. I stuck a for sale sign in the front yard for him, gave him a discount on my commission, and we were able to get the property sold immediately. Uh-huh. And I've also been very successful with doing reverse mortgage short sales. A lot of times these reverse mortgages are put on a property, just depends on where they're located geographically, will determine whether or not the property is going to appreciate or depreciate. In this particular case, the property lost about $30,000 in value. So the mortgage company had no problem in accepting a short sale. As a matter of fact, I've probably negotiated about 800 or 900 short sales in my since 1988. I've never had one rejected.
Wow. Now, what are the hot areas in town nowadays?
This part of Atlanta. Anywhere Atlanta. Right now, a lot of people are investing in these areas that near downtown where the property values, they can get these houses for like $20,000 or $30,000, do a major renovation on them and sell the properties for $150,000, $200,000. So you have a lot of pockets of metropolitan Atlanta. That's actually
a lot of gentrification in the downtown area, like Summerhill and Cabbage Town.
Exactly. Especially Cabbage Town. That's a good thing and it's a bad thing. A lot of homeowners advocate for homeownership. And so when a client approaches me, I have to make a determination on whether or not I can help that client. I've actually had people not make a mortgage payment in over 10 years because they understand how to finagle the system.
You can finagle the system for 10 years?
Even longer. Yeah. And let me give you just some hints on that.
That's crazy.
Well, it is, but those folks know how to file bankruptcy, pro se. The wife can go file, and that will buy about 8 or 9 months. The husband could go and turn around and refile. That'll buy about 8 or 9 months. The wife can go back and have a bankruptcy case reopened. You can file a wrongful foreclosure case against the mortgage company.
And you're still living there.
You're still living there the entire time, rent-free, mortgage-free.
Wow.
The problem is when I get these clients, I have to determine, being a broker, a licensee, advocating for homeowners and enabling people to continue the foolishness, I have to make a discernment on that. And at the end of the day, what my system, the expertise of my system is really is to have everyone involved in a transaction shaking hands later. Mortgage company, the homeowner.
And the bank and everybody.
Exactly right.
So that's probably those people aren't a good philosophical fit.
Exactly. And it's funny because the only people that's crying about the banks have done them wrong are the people that's not making mortgage payments. Isn't that amazing? So I had another client who he approached me. He was a real estate broker, had been in the business much long before I was born. But he never had a problem with making his payments. Something happened in his life. He had degenerative heart disease and he was preparing to die. He had about $1.5 million of equity in the property. He had this home built, elevators in it, it was a gorgeous home. And his goal was to keep the mortgage company off his back long enough so he can make his transition, sell the property, give the equity to his wife so she can go and pay cash for a home and keep it moving because his life insurance was very minimal and he really had nothing to leave her. His mortgage payment was about $8,000 a month. He had not made a payment in about 3 years. So his attorney referred him to one of the top people in Georgia, myself, is included within the top 10 that specialize in what I do in the entire United States. An attorney located me and said, hey, listen, I've exhausted all the legal options. What else could be done to prolong this situation? Make a long story short, we were able to negotiate a settlement with the mortgage company. End up being a short sale because although the property had $1.5 million equity in it, a property that is sellable versus a property that is marketable are totally different.
Right.
This property's equity meant nothing because the home was built specific for he and his wife's likes.
Right.
So folks were coming in. We didn't like this. So it would have been a rehab for a lot of folks. So they were lowballing the offers. But we end up getting a foreclosure sale stopped in this property 3 additional times with my techniques. Before this gentleman died on his deathbed, I end up seeing him and he, just hugged me and embraced me. His wife was standing there. We were able to get the foreclosure sale stopped that last time. Sold the property. His wife walked away with about $50,000 and he was okay with that.
Mm-hmm. And then right now, you're launching an online course. Now it's your chance to be the one teaching others.
And I'm so glad to hear from your first guest because I definitely plan on engaging her services. But my books are all about what I do, but not more like a do-it-yourself type situation, but it makes it easier when you're engaged in it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I am one person. I've been doing this since 1988. I am now 52 years old, and I want to do other things with my time. My oldest child is 32 years old, and I have a 4-year-old now. So I'm kind of starting this process all over again. And I'm really enjoying this side of my life. But what I love doing is helping people. And so this book that I'm writing is actually a course, and it's called Second Chance Homebuyers. And it's about dealing with people that have had a life crisis that need homeownership or need housing today, but they have a series of things that have gotten them out of whack.
Right. So there's some hurdles.
Exactly right. And this book teaches you not only how to get around those hurdles, but how to address those hurdles and deal with them today.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very complicated real estate market that we in. Things are constantly changing. For instance, as of July 1st, the Dodd-Frank has been relaxed to where banks are able to lend more, which is a beautiful thing. However, as of July 1st, the 4506 has changed. So now a homeowner cannot, a third party mortgage company can't get direct access to your taxes. You actually can order the tax transcript. So if I go and apply for a loan, the mortgage company, I'm going to sign a 4506T or 4506EZ, allowing them to pull my tax transcripts. Even though I'm giving you my physical tax returns, they don't believe that. They want to get it directly from the IRS. Well, as of July 1st, the IRS do not send third parties at all tax returns. You can request it, but it has to go directly to the homeowner, and a homeowner can send it to the individual third party. And we understand why that was put into effect.
Right. But so that's OK. But I can't hand them the paper.
They can't get it directly from the IRS.
Right. But
so
I
that's
can,
a huge chance
I can get
fraud.
It from the IRS and then I can hand them
as you the right. actual taxpayer. Yes.
So that creates more complexity for me now. I'm in this a little bit.
Well, the mortgage company is banking on information coming directly from the tax from the IRS as factual.
Right.
But if there's a third party intervening, which is the original borrower, taxpayer, there's more chance for
fraud. So when is this course going to become available? What's the timeline?
It's available now, but for it to be actually downloadable, and we're going to say by the end of this month, maybe the first week of August, just to be on the safe side.
So if somebody wants to get their hands on it, where do they go?
They come to either www.kiplingrec.com or they can call my office at 770-691-3050.
All right. Well, thank you so much, David, for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Hang with us. We got the headliner coming up. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, straight from the offices of Porter, Keitel, and Moore, Mr. Pat Tooley. Welcome.
Thank you.
Did you learn anything there? You got a real estate, some info on real estate, audiobooks. There's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. I need to listen to more of these radio programs.
So tell us about Porter, Keitel, Moore. How are you serving folks?
Sure. So Porter, Keitel, Moore is a firm. We've been around for 40 years. We're a CPA firm. So we do accounting services, advisory, tax, and we work with a lot of smart startup businesses. That is kind of we're a small business, a growing business, and we work with a lot of people that are starting businesses or their businesses are growing. They're trying to take their businesses to the next level.
And then you have a specialty, though, that's unlike most others in this line of work.
We've developed a number of specialties over the year. When we first started off 40 years ago, we were in the insurance industry, and we worked with a lot of ag businesses. Over the years, we developed a niche in community banking, community banks. We probably are very familiar with a bunch of those. And then through a merger, acquired another firm that had a community banking niche. So that was kind of one of our big niches. And really, until about 10 years ago, Georgia was a significant environment for startup banks.
Right. There was a period of time it seemed like every week there was a new bank opening.
That's right. So, we had a lot of experience working with startup companies, particularly in the banking industry. The other thing that we saw evolve here was a lot of financial technology companies or fintech companies.
Right.
So we've worked also being involved in the community bank space, got involved with a lot of those financial technology companies. So and through that process, whether it was in the insurance area, financial technology, community banking space, we really came to understand the value that we could provide to clients through specialization and understanding their industries. So about 4 or 5 years ago, as we were seeing a new evolving industry in Georgia, the Georgia craft beer industry, we had talked about it for several years. We ended up hiring a guy that was a home brewer, and that kind of pushed us over the edge at that point. We said, well, let's explore this and see what we could do with this. So about 4 or 5 years ago, we got involved with the Georgia Craft Brewers Guild, got involved with a couple of the other kind of luminaries in the area, and kicked off this business. And what we found is it was a very nice overlay with our startup business experience. Right. Working with, you know, entrepreneurs, helping them, you know, a very quickly evolving business. So over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, we have become the number one firm serving Georgia craft brewers.
Are there a lot of craft brewers?
When we started, there were 40 to 50 in Georgia. Nationally, that number in 2018 eclipsed 7,000.
7,000 nationally?
Nationally.
So what changed that all of a sudden there's a ton of craft brewers?
Well, a lot of the states had changed their rules as it pertained to craft brewers. And I mean, you know, bottom line is, you know, we see this with restaurants and farm to table. We see this with where people shop for their groceries. Things are becoming more and more local. People enjoy kind of having that local touch point. And that trend kind of caught on in the craft beer space. You know, go back many, many years to, you know, Sam Adams and the Boston Beer Company, or Sierra Nevada, and a few of the early pioneers in that. And what we saw is some of the barriers to entry kept, you know, as states became more receptive to smaller and smaller craft breweries, that people started opening more. You know, much like us, they looked at Georgia craft brewing and said, "This is a pretty cool business. I enjoy craft beer, like, and nothing more enjoyable on a weekend than sipping on it."
So, like, at first it started with hobbyists just kind of playing around and saying, "Look, I can make this. Like, how hard is it?" And they just started figuring out how to kind of brew their own stuff.
Yeah. So,
was that illegal, or was that always legal?
No. So, with beer, and this is different from spirits, but with beer, you can brew your own beer. So,
and that's totally legal.
Totally legal.
I can go to Amazon and buy some stuff.
That's right. That's right. There are trade associations geared specifically to homebrewers.
Right.
And actually, the leading advocate of of craft beer in the country is the Brewers Association, which originally started off as a home brewers association.
And then it evolved where some people are like, "Hey, your stuff's pretty good. Why don't you like do this for other people and try to sell it?"
Yes. So
it evolved from that?
Yeah. So people, I mean, here in Atlanta, there are a number of those stories where people, Monday Night Brewing, was a church group that would get together. With a church group, and they would get together and they said, "Hey, let's start brewing some beer." And they were brewing a lot of beer, so they invited more friends over, and because they had some more beer than they could drink. And it really evolved then into, you know, people encouraged them to say, you know, "Why don't you do this on a full-time basis?" So that is a very typical story. There are a lot of people that got involved in this in a small scale, got into it a number of years ago, that have just really ridden the wave of craft brewing around the country.
And then you can, once you kind of make that mental leap of selling it, now you can be as big as you want to be at this point, right? Like, or is there limitations now? Is there limitations from a legal standpoint? I understand there would be limitations from, like, I got to buy equipment, I got to have money and investors and things like that. But legally, like, once I say, okay, I can sell it to my neighbors, then can I sell it anywhere in the country? Like, where's kind of the...
So, and one of the barriers to entry, one of the things that does restrict the growth of craft brewers is it's a very intricate regulatory scheme. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, a brewer is a manufacturer. Well, they typically cannot sell their own beer to customers, but there are exemptions for direct-to-customer sales. So you typically have to then sell your beer to distributors within a defined marketplace, geographic area.
So the distributors, though, is that just because of liquor? Or is, like, if I was selling widgets that were made of wood, I wouldn't necessarily have to have a distributor?
Just right. Because of liquor.
So liquor has its own set of rules.
Yes, it does. It does. So, yeah, and it's referred to as a three-tier system. So there are manufacturers who are your brewers, distillers, winemakers. Then there's the distributors who are the wholesalers. And then the third tier are retailers, you know, retail
outlets.
Like
the liquor store or the restaurant is a retailer?
Restaurant, that's exactly right. So
now where do the growlers fit into this? What are they?
So a growler, all that is and typically where we see that is with at the brewers in their locations. They're able now under Georgia law and under most states' laws to sell their beer directly to consumers. A growler became an easy way for them to basically pour their beer into a container for customers to take that
without
with them to
a distributor.
Without a distributor, without having a canning line, right. Things like that. So a fairly cost-effective way
so
to
do that. So allows entrepreneurs to kind of play a little bit without a lot of resources, money, and stuff.
That's right. So, I mean, a typical startup model will be somebody brews their own beer, they can sell it across the counter to you in their tasting room, mm-hmm. or they can sell that beer to go. And again, the early stages of that was growlers and crawlers, which were that allowed your customer to experience your product at home. They could take it with them.
So now once you kind of dip your toe into this water and you say, okay, we're going to kind of be the go-to CPA firm for craft beer. Is there a lot of competition or are there other CPAs saying, hey, I want to get involved? Or did you have this kind of to yourself?
In Georgia, we found there really wasn't a concentration of CPAs doing this. There were a lot of CPA firms. Every brewery had a CPA, but there really wasn't a concentration of that. So from a competitive standpoint, it was a great spot for us to get in. And again, doing the homework on the industry, understanding all the specific issues for the industry gives us a huge leg up then when we're talking to prospective clients.
Because there's a lot of little things that become big things if you don't pay attention, right?
That's right. We actually have a list. It's my not a dirty dozen. It's more than a dozen things at this point. But there are a lot of commonly missed items that pertain specifically to breweries or manufacturers, but from either a regulatory, a tax, business standpoint, getting business loans and things like that. And we've developed that list. And typically when we're talking to a client, we go down and, you know, throw some of those out. We're not very many of our prospective clients are missing every one of them, but nobody's batting a thousand either.
Now, we're talking specifically about craft beer, but we just recently had somebody that opened a vodka distillery. Is that a totally different thing, or that's kind of adjacent to what you guys do?
It's adjacent. We actually have several distillery clients as well. So it's a different federal license. There's a craft brewer's license, there are distiller's license, and then there are farm winery and wine license, mm-hmm. winery licenses. So different. But
they're
similar.
In the neighborhood.
They're in the neighborhood.
And then so you'd be able to serve all of those people as well.
That's correct. Similar and, regulatory structure right. in terms of the three tiers, distributors.
And kind of that checklist probably applies a lot of it.
It does. So distillers, by and large, are also considered manufacturers. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the same rules apply to them.
And then they typically go through a distributor. And they don't, I guess they could have a little tasting room, but the vast majority of their revenue will come from distributors, though.
Yes and no. I mean, so there's, I mean, here in Atlanta, we've got ASW is a big distiller. They have a fairly large tasting room. But, yeah, I mean, people are not going in there and having, you know, probably the same volume of distilled spirits,
right.
drinks that they would maybe having a beer or two. Now, when the to-go product, you know, selling a bottle of whiskey or vodka or something like that to go, obviously there's a probably a larger sale there as opposed to, you know, selling a six pack or a case of beer.
So now what's your biggest success thus far?
Well, our biggest success is, as I mentioned earlier, is just the traction that we've got in this industry. We currently are working with 12 breweries that are open for business out of the roughly 70 or 80. There are another 80 to 100 breweries in planning. We refer to them as dreamers. And we're working with another 12 to 15 of those. So at this point, you know, we're working with somewhere between, you know, 12 and 25 breweries. So that success has been very, you know, sometimes we try something, we go into a new market industry, and, you know, a lot of times, you know, if you're lucky if you're batting, you know, 250 or 300.
Sure.
So, you know, it's great to see the success and the traction. And again, I think we're a very good fit for them as small emerging businesses. We can help them beyond just their basic accounting to help them think about strategic, kind of their finance department, if you will, to help them with their growth and evolution.
Now, do you find this to be the case where, like, you're working in this niche of craft beer, And then, you know, then the distillery, like these other kind of adjacent things come, and that makes sense. Now, do people, like, there's a pro and con when any business says, I'm going all in on a niche, you know, because then they're like, oh, they're the crap beer people. They wouldn't understand my manufacturing or something like that. You know, that's kind of a, that's a fear for a lot of entrepreneurs, that if I do go and say I am great at this, then I'm not going to get any other business. My feeling is that's not necessarily the case. You know, you might be great at that, and you might know where all the danger is and where all the opportunity is because you are so immersed in it. But that still opens doors for other things as well. Like, this hasn't hurt your business by going niche in craft beer, has it?
No, it has not. As a matter of fact, I think it expands our we've had that exact experience where people said, oh, you guys just do a bunch of community banks, or you're into financial technology. Now they're seeing that we have kind of multiple verticals, multiple industry niches, and that we can function in those. And I mean, and frankly, a lot of the small business things are very common. Again, there's certainly some specific things related to craft beer or community banking and things like that. But the small business piece of it is very, very usual in terms of I'm starting up a business. You know, I got to do certain, you know, comply with all the different tax laws. I have to, I'm typically getting some borrowing from the bank or from the Small Business Administration, different things like that. So there's a lot of common themes there that once you work with small and startup businesses, we can kind of conglomerate or aggregate those and our experiences there and, you know, present that to a prospective client as well.
So now when you work with a business or an entrepreneur or a startup that is different than an enterprise level, right? Because sometimes the sophistication isn't there and they don't know what they don't know and things like that. What is kind of working with you feel like? Is this something where I just, you know, dump a box of tax receipts at the end of the year and that's our relationship? Or is it more proactive and you're trying to kind of consult and coach me up, you know, maybe on a regular rhythm?
Yeah. Our goal is to kind of plug those gaps and to truly be a complement. We work with, you know, some of our clients are fairly sophisticated from a financial accounting and reporting standpoint. Some of them are home brewers and they've got a day job doing something else and they don't understand, you know, have never run a business. Some of our clients have run small businesses before, but again, they're not accounting and tax experts. So depending upon what their needs are, we've got bookkeepers on staff. We've got people that can work at all different levels with them. So we just, our goal is to meet with each of them, understand what their needs are, and then build services that complement whatever it is that they need. And then, again, work with them and coach them to kind of help their businesses get to the next level. So we do work with some startups. There are several companies that have gone through significant expansion as we've been working with them. We do work with Creature Comforts in Athens. And they started off, had a tremendous success at their original location in downtown Athens. And just a little over a year ago, year and a half or so ago, opened a second location, primarily a production facility that greatly expanded their distribution capacity. So, you know, those are stories. They've got a very sophisticated financial group that they work with. But then you dial that all the way back to a guy that's been brewing in his garage and wants to take his dream to the next level and kind of explore that.
And then so there's so you prefer relationships that are more kind of proactive and you're not just reacting to a bunch of receipts at the end of the year, though. That's your preference.
Correct. I mean, what we're trying to do is raise everybody's game to try and make their business, give their business the best chance of success.
So if somebody wanted to learn more and have more substantive conversation, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
You can on our website, www.pkm.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the Thirsty CPA is a brand that we have developed and developed a lot of content on that. But it's fairly easy. If you type in Georgia Craft Brewing and Accounting, we will pop up.
I'm sure pretty high.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Pat, for sharing your story today.
Thank you.
All right. That's a wrap for Atlanta Business Radio. We will see you all next time.